It's the business.
The Hot Desk with Mary O'Neill on WLR.
Thanks to MK Brazel, Chartered Accountants and Tax Advisors.
Good evening, you're very welcome along to tonight's Hot Desk, the first of 2026. Happy New Year to all of you. Lots to talk about between now and 7 o'clock. We're going to hear about sustainable clothing company Millie Design, based in Tramore. Also, I'll speak to a Tramore-based fractional CFO. If that's a new phrase to you, it'll all be explained very shortly. That's all coming up here on the Hot Desk. The Society of the Irish Motor Industry, SIMI, last Friday officially released their statistics for 2025. I find this really interesting. These are released every month, by the way, but to see the overall picture. New car registrations in total reached 124,954, a 3% increase when compared to 2024. And imported used cars saw 71,813 registrations in 2025, a 16.6% increase on 2024, which is significant. But the biggest jump was in electric vehicles, or EVs. 23,601 new electric cars were registered in Ireland in 2025, and that's an increase of 35.1% year on year on 2024. So a really big jump. To talk about this and lots more, I am delighted now to be joined by the Deputy Director General of the SIMI, Tom Cullen, who's based in Waterford. Tom, how are you doing?
Hey, Mary. All good. How are you?
Not too bad. Great to see you again. Thanks very much for coming in. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Busy time of the year for you guys. And I do love these kind of roundup statistics. It's interesting to see where the motor industry is going, isn't it?
Yeah. It gives us a great opportunity to sort of plan for the year as well. Believe it or not, it's almost a quieter time for us because the industry is so busy in the first 3 months that it gives us an opportunity to prepare for the year. But like as you said, nice roundup of the whole year. Good to have the conversation about it and the chats about see what the next year looks like. Figures up 3% on last year in terms of new car registrations. That's a good news story. Mm-hmm. You know, we would argue that there's a lot more in the market. Like if you look at where we should be for a flourishing economy, we should probably be in around 140,000 to 150,000 new cars per year. Cars are expensive now. They're becoming more and more expensive if we put more safety, more technology into them, more, you know, luxury items that people want in cars. So they are becoming much more expensive. So it's affecting the numbers. But, you know, we've had a good year. We're 3% up in terms of 2024. It looks like this year will be probably somewhat the same. You know, we'd love to say it'd be at 130,000 new cars, probably a little bit better than this year, but not by too much. But the headline story is the mix, as in what's happening to the different vehicles types that we have. So we now have a huge increase in the number of electric vehicles at 35% increase on last year. That's better than 2023, which is the best year to date. So we are moving, the trajectory is moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
But we've a long way to go, you know, an awful long way to go.
Absolutely. And I suppose, you know, the 35% is a whopper of a jump year on year between 2025 and 2024. But you've made a valid point there. 2024 was a particularly bad year for electric vehicles. So I suppose that has to be taken into account. But even as that's taken into account, it is still quite a positive jump, isn't it, in terms of electric vehicle registrations?
Yeah, it is. 2023 was really good, but I suppose we in Ireland have a good basket of goods in terms of the government incentives towards moving people in the direction of electrification of vehicles. So they're very, very good. The difficulty is that as soon as you pull back on them, and in 2023 the state pulled the €5,000 upfront grant, they took that from 5,000 down to 3,500, and that immediately has a negative effect on purchasing. So now you could pick that up at a later stage, but that was a negative. So I think we aren't selling enough electric vehicles to pull any type of incentives at this point. And we've learned that throughout Europe.
Yeah.
The average is about 13% of electric vehicles now. We're way off where we would have initially planned to be as a European.
Where are we now? I mean, we're talking about the 35% jump, but in separate percentage conversations then, like roughly what percentage of the national fleet at this stage would be electrified?
Yeah, so tiny in comparison, right?
Okay.
So we have the electric vehicle fleet targets that the state put in place for 2020. 2025, we've achieved them, which that's a really good news story, right? But what you have is you sort of have the early adapters, the people that choose to go for electric immediately. They don't care what the technology is like. They're just going to go. They want it. They're going to go for it. You can only get it in new car buyers because we haven't developed a secondhand market. You know, majority of people will never have the luxury of being able to buy a new car. There's only the fortunate few that can do that. So it takes a while to get that. So really, this is about improving the new car market. If you have a bigger new car market, you have a bigger percentage of the sales that are electric, you get towards your targets quicker. So at the moment, we have 185,000 was the target for 2025. We beat that. We've over 100,000 electric vehicles. Some of these now, the electrification of vehicles is plug-in hybrid vehicles that's in those targets, but it's very, very good. The difficulty now is that once you get past the early adapters phase of the market, you're trying to get into the early majority, and the early majority a lot more difficult to move to electrification than the others. One, it's very expensive to move. You know, they want secondhand cars, they want secondhand affordable cars, they want secondhand affordable cars that will not have range anxiety, which they don't now. We used to have a big range anxiety.
Yeah.
That's gone now. It's more about charging anxiety.
So the charging anxiety.
That's where we've moved to. Yeah, we want to see more, visibly more fast chargers on the national networks.
Anecdotally, I do have friends who bought secondhand electric cars recently, though. Like, it's not a complete no-go area either. Like, there are people doing it.
It's 2020. Look, we're starting to see every year now, as we sell more and more new cars, we're going to see more and more used cars available. Yeah. And there's lots of really, really good quality used cars available on the used car websites and through the dealership networks, secondhand cars. There was a problem there 2 years ago when we couldn't sell electric secondhand cars because nobody could really put the value on them. But now we're starting to evolve that market.
Sure.
We have secondhand cars. We know what the value of them is. We know what the cost of change is. So it's a lot more robust, the market, in terms of secondhand cars.
I suppose the age-old conversation, and there will be people listening who will be kind of saying, what about the infrastructure? I mean, really, we're still at a stage, am I right in saying that if you don't have a home charger, and there are reasons why people can't have a home charger, they might be in apartment blocks, they mightn't have a front garden, that actually it is difficult to keep an electric car. And I know with the ZEVI plans on the motorways and that, there's a lot of rollout of public-private partnerships and that going to happen in the next 12 months, but we probably need to get there a bit faster as well.
Yeah, God, you're good on it, Mary. You're 100% right. You know, we have people that, you know, don't have the ability to put a fast charger in their house, but compared to every other country in Europe, we're way more accessible to putting chargers in houses. Most people live in houses where they can put a charger.
Good point. There
are many that can't, of course, and we need to be able to provide for that. But most people who are in a position that they can put a charger into their house, more so than anywhere other countries. So we've created a great opportunity on that. In terms of range, every single vehicle now doesn't have to worry about range. They're all 450, 500 kilometres. There's very few, unless you're a sales rep covering the Munster area every single day, you're not really, the range is not a big problem for you. The only thing I would say, it's the limiting factor that stops you making the jump towards electrification. So if you take the biggest survey in the world, with 300,000 electric vehicle owners across Canada and the United States, and in 95% of those houses they had a second car that was an internal combustion car.
Sure.
So they knew that they were never going to be stuck, and that's why we're seeing probably a big shift towards, a big move in the direction of hybrid, plug-in hybrids, where that, you know, range anxiety is not a factor at all. But as we would always say, if you're buying a new car, look at your range, look at how many times you take a trip, a long distance trip. If you do, nearly every electric vehicle on the market now is going to get you anywhere in Ireland in one charge. And then you're only going to have to charge it in the destination that you go to and come back again. So it's very, very accessible now. We used to have a huge problem with range anxiety. It was a real factor of the limited. Now, cost is always the factor, is the number one. But number two was range. That's been dropped now. And number two now is charging anxiety. People want to know, well, if I do take that trip, I want to be able to charge halfway up on the motorway to Dublin or halfway to Cork, and the visibility of those fast chargers are not there. Yes, you're right, ZEVI is doing the work on it, but it needs to happen quicker. The planning process needs to allow for that. The investment needs to come from, you know, public and private providers. And then once you see that, people go, oh, now I'm comfortable. It makes sense. I'll go for it. But like electric vehicles, for anyone that's driven them, like, they're fantastic.
They are. And I suppose there is the environmental factor that needs to be mentioned as well.
Of course.
I mean, we need to start looking that way, don't we, into the future. If we, you know,
it's the low hanging fruit, Mary, of, yeah, of all the things that we do in terms of in making an environmental footprint better. If you can afford it, buying an electric car is a massive step in the right direction. Yes, there's a carbon input cost of developing the car itself, but once you start driving it, you know, you're using your own. And for people that now we're getting solar panels in houses, you're going to be able to feed that energy created by yourself into your car to be able to use it for travel. So look, it's there's no question it's going to happen. You know, that's not in any doubt. There might be a mix of other vehicle types that are out there, but electrification is the main one. And if you think we all have electricity at home, you know, to create any other hydrogen fuel cell batteries or anything, you're going to have to create infrastructure out of nothing. We all have that electricity infrastructure at the moment. So electric vehicles are our future. The only thing is, it's probably not happening as quickly as government would have liked, as the environmentalists would have liked, and we as an industry would have liked. But we are getting that momentum now. It's just going to take some time to get to the holy grail, and we are going to need to keep incentives. We're going to need probably more incentives, some of those focused on rural areas, some of those focused on specific groups to try and move them to electric vehicles when they're making that change out from an old to a new. And also for companies, because they're the quickest ones. They have a car for 3 or 4 years and then they turn it into a secondhand car. So creating that secondhand market is, you know, is a real priority for, you know, for most people then who want to buy a secondhand car that's electric.
Okay, we are pretty much bang out of time. I did want to talk to you about loads of other things. If you had 30 seconds to give advice for somebody who's thinking of getting a car in 2026, my God, it's 2026, what would you say?
Oh, well, first of all, like, the number of electric vehicles, I'm blown away by the number of vehicles that are available now. There's about 130 new electric vehicles out of them. Lots of them are now are smaller and under €30,000. So there is something for everybody in the market, right up to the prestige models. I would say, if you're thinking about it, now is the time to sort of examine in your driver behaviour. I don't think about it too much, my own driving behaviour, but look at the type of travel you're taking. Look at the trips you're doing during the week. Look at the type of mileage, the places that you're going. Examine that. Focus on your budget. Very, very good finance deals out there on new vehicles at the moment. So look at the budget that you're available to spend. Like, everything's on the internet. You can search anything and anywhere to find the type of vehicle that might suit you once you know your right criteria. Then get yourself into a few garages and have a look at the lovely stuff that's out there. A couple of shows on around the Ireland, around Ireland on electric vehicles. Look out for those shows every year where you can go and see every vehicle that's available from every manufacturer. But it's a great time, and the industry is doing well. People are servicing their cars, they're looking after their cars, and it's a good time for us. We're doing well too.
Great stuff. Tom Cullen of the Society of the Irish Motor Industry, thank you very much for coming.
Thanks, Mary.
The Hot Desk with Mary O'Neill, WLR's business programme.
Thanks to MK Brazel, Chartered Accountants and Tax Advisors.
Well, if one of your goals in 2026 is to become more sustainable, there's a big chance you've thought about moving away from fast fashion as well. Lots of people are going on the likes of Vinted, but there are also a lot of makers in Waterford creating sustainable clothes. One of those is Millie Designs, and the person behind it is Catherine de Courcy, and I'm delighted to say she joins me in studio. Catherine, how are you doing?
Hiya, I'm doing good. How are you doing today?
Not too bad at all, not too bad. Catherine, really looking forward to kind of discussing what you make at Millie Designs, but tell me first a little bit about yourself, your background, how you landed ultimately in Tremore.
It's kind of a bit of a long story. Like, I started off in New Zealand and met my husband in Australia after I moved there, and was pregnant and in Tremore at the time, and was looking kind of for stuff to do, because when you've got babies at home, you kind of have nothing really. Well, not nothing. I shouldn't say that, should I? Really?
Busy with babies, but you're looking for something else.
Yeah,
of course.
Keep your brain busy. And when my youngest was at the time, was drooling a lot. He was like nonstop drooler, and I couldn't find any bibs at all to keep him under control and to keep his chest dry.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I like sewing. I can give this a go. I can figure out something that's going to make this solution for me, like make a solution. And that's what we did. I just made bibs. I started off making little baby bibs and little harem pants to match, little combos. And I'm like, this could be something I could actually do, because people were interested in, like, the meetings I'd go along to, the breastfeeding groups and the Quidgy groups. And be like, what's your child wearing?
Yeah.
Because they were comfortable and they were practical and they were useful. And that's how it kind of started. Just started by, like, I saw a need and I filled it.
And where did the name Millie Designs come from?
So my eldest child, when she was born, we named her Emily, and we decided on Millie because it was like Emily, but without the E.
It's very cute, actually.
Yeah.
I suppose in terms then of the product you're making, because obviously the range has expanded. That was many years ago.
Many years.
And Millie Designs is still going strong.
It is.
But you make quite a broad range of clothes now, and not just for kids. So talk me through some of your products.
So the main goal of Millie Designs has always been comfort and colour and practical. I want the main goal was for kids to be comfortable when they were playing and being able to wear a bright clothes, but be comfortable while they're wearing them, and also be hard wearing. So from then I've moved on to adult clothing. So I make amazing underpants. They're my favourite thing.
When you say underpants, I mean...
Knickers.
Because I traditionally think of underpants as like men's clothes.
Well, mainly for female bodies.
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, so knickers, I make all styles of underpants, and they're with no elastic, because I can't stand elastic myself personally. So none of my clothes in general would have any elastic in them. They're all made with beautiful cotton lycra. And I do try and aim towards using organic cotton lycra, bit more earth friendly and a bit more nicer on skin and harder wearing.
Okay, now I'm not a sewing expert by any stretch of the imagination, but if you're removing elastic from things like underwear, you obviously need to put a really good cut on them to keep them kind of, you know, from falling down, I suppose.
Definitely, yeah. So with the fabrics, they're all, like the cotton fabrics are all a mix of cotton and lycra, and the lycra itself is the elastic, so it has the stretches built into the fabric. So all the waistbands and the leg bands are made with the cotton lycra fabric, which keeps them like tight around your waist. Mine don't fall down. So.
Yeah. No, I think it's a really brilliant idea. And I suppose like that, you have to put kind of a lot of effort into making the shape exactly as you want it to stay as well. Yes. And what about washing them and everything then?
I'm really hard wearing. Well, my kids are really hard wearing on the clothing, and I don't like to sort or do anything extra when it comes to washing of the clothing. So everything gets thrown on the machine. I recommend a 30 to 40 degree wash, but you can wash them hotter if you need to. And I do chuck everything in the dryer. So everything of mine goes into the dryer. For longevity, you'd probably want to keep them on the line, line dry them, but they work just fine.
Which is a huge bonus.
They do, but like they would seriously last a lot longer if they were in. If I was line drying them, but they still last up ages. I've got my youngest child's now 6, and he's wearing underpants that I made for my 14-year-old when they were 6.
No way.
Yeah.
This is quite a visual part of the interview, I suppose.
Yes.
But, you know, and people can find Millie Designs on Instagram. But the colour, the pops of colour, it has to be seen to be believed. I mean, it's you know, so some of the trousers are almost psychedelic. I love
They really are. The patterns are amazing. I adore fabric.
And where do you get those patterns, or how does all that come about?
So it can be a complex process. Like you can buy a file, like a digital file, and then get it printed on fabric. You can just order from fabric companies, fabric suppliers. I do a bit of both. So I have a supplier in China who I order my organic cotton lycra from, and I send him files and he prints them for me on fabric and they arrive. Or I can just order them from other fabric companies. And I have actually designed a print myself. I didn't draw it, but I designed it with an artist. It's of my house, actually. It's really cute.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And you're wearing a top, obviously, from your adult range.
Yes.
And it's kind of fireflies, are they?
They're like little angels. They're very interesting.
With kind of with fluorescent light in their bodies and on their faces. And so they're almost like little angels meets fireflies meets butterflies. And then, like I said, the kids' designs are really, really cool. And sometimes I think, you know, when we go to other countries, I think people are more likely to be wearing really bright colours. Mm-hmm. We're not really known for very bright colours, I don't think, on this side of the world.
Well, I've kind of loved that with my kids, because whenever they're dressed in my Millie Designs clothing, I can spot them anywhere. They never get lost. Like, I always find them in a crowd.
Yeah, exactly. But I think there's, especially I think when it's dark and, you know, Ireland can be very, very dark time of the year, that it's actually really nice to just, sometimes I think we just need to be a bit braver about wearing colours. I think kids are brave about colours, but maybe adults could be braver.
I agree.
Yeah.
I definitely think so. I have some amazing fabrics for adults. And like I do get to make stuff out of them, which is great.
So you're online only at the moment in terms of how you sell and stock and all that?
Mostly, yes. I do have a small selection of items in at the Magpie Collective in Waterford. It's in the Viking Triangle there. A beautiful little shop full of like amazing all Irish makers. Just a little plug for them there.
Absolutely.
And I do have some items, both adults and kids clothing, in the Magpie as well.
I suppose there's a serious message that I mentioned at the start of the interview and all of this, and that's that you know, we are, I suppose we are all becoming more conscious of how we consume everything in mm-hmm. life. But I mean, you know, anybody who's seen some of the documentaries and that on fast fashion, like, it would kind of knock you off your bike in terms of what it's doing to the planet.
Yes.
So, you know, you're somebody, I suppose, who is conscientiously going against the fast fashion movement as well.
Yes. Although I am trying to sell the items that I make, I don't want people to be buying unnecessary, like unnecessarily. It's kind of a weird catch 22 for me because I don't want people to be over consuming, but I do want them to buy my items. I do think they are really good quality and they do last for such a long time. I've had many like friends. Most of my customers are friends because they're so lovely, but they hand their stuff down to their next kid, or they give them back to me to give to someone else, or they like this, like so many, there's more than one child per item of clothing. You know what I mean? Like they've been through like four or five or six kids. They go on for years and years and years. And also I do offer like a repair service. So if you have a pair of pants that the seam splits or the butt splits or whatever, or you need like a repair somewhere that I can do, I will repair for free as well.
And I love that because I think, you know, and it probably is the same nowadays, to be fair, but certainly growing up in the 80s and 90s, you know, hand-me-downs were a thing.
100%.
Always. Like most of the clothes I wore, I was the fifth child of six with cousins and you know, friends and neighbours and everything, and everything just got handed down. Like, is that, do you think that still is happening?
I do think it's still happening. Probably not enough. Like, I think it could be happening a lot more, but it's hard. Like, I don't judge anyone that buys clothing from Pennies or from wherever.
Absolutely.
Like, not at all, because people do their best.
Yeah.
Everyone's doing their best. But with those clothes, you don't get as much chance to hand them down because they do tend to, they skew a bit. In, I think I was saying to you earlier, like I'm really particular about how I cut the clothing. So the grain line is all running a particular way. So when you wash it, it doesn't end up skewing to the left or to the right or a funny angle. And Pennies don't do that as much because of their cutting piles of fabric all in one go.
Because it's mass produced, I suppose.
They might have like 10, 50 layers of fabric that are all cutting to make the same pattern, whereas I cut every leg one time, like once, one at a time, you know what I mean?
And you were saying that you do things with your leftover cuts as well.
I don't like throwing anything out. Like, I'm really bad at not throwing anything out. My husband hates me for it. but I don't like to see it wasted. So everything, the biggest scraps I use to make the bibs, and scrunchies or headbands or small hats. And the really small bits I use to make face rounds. My face rounds are really quite popular. They're great for makeup removal. And I make kitchen wipes and like anything I can use, I'll use to try and reduce my waste as much as possible.
So you're running the company 13 years now.
Yes.
Like, what kind of changes have you seen then? What has become more popular, less popular? What are customers looking for that's changed maybe over the years?
When I first started, it was very all about the fabric, like all about buying the big, bright, bold, beautiful colours. And I still do that personally. That's my passion, is still like the fabric, the crazy, interesting fabrics. But I have noticed a shift in the, like even the big departments, that they tend to do that as well. But people are kind of moving away from the colours as much, which makes me a bit sad because I wish they would still go. So I do have a range of less crazy fabrics as well, so we can like try and meet everyone's needs.
And the creative process, because I suppose, again, kind of going back to, like, a lot of things are kind of coming full circle, I think. But, you know, say maybe our parents' generation or, you know, the generation maybe that would have come up through the 50s and 60s and 70s, like, sewing was just what you did then.
And that's why I started sewing, because my mum and my grandma
really
sewed. Yeah.
Yeah. And you grew up in New Zealand and then Australia subsequently.
Yeah.
And they sewed. So you learned from them, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you enjoy that process? Like, is it kind of, can it be quite laborious, or is it just a mindful thing for you?
Some parts can be very laborious. Mm-hmm. Like, I hate using a normal sewing machine, like the traditional sewing machines where it's just like a straight stitch. I find those quite hard to use, but I love my overlocker. My overlocker is my baby.
So now what's an overlocker?
So that does like the inside seams. I can show you on my shirt that I'm wearing at my hub. But it does like it works really well for stretchy fabrics.
Okay.
But it's like it brings two fabrics together. It has two needles and two loopers. And it just does the seams It looks like a professional scene.
Yeah, it really does. So for people obviously who can't see, I'm the only person who can see this. Everyone can't. No, that's okay. So Catherine has just kind of shown me what does look like a really professional in scene. So you're doing all of that yourself. Yeah.
Yes.
So obviously you know, and as you're someone who doesn't like waste, you just really need to cut, measure and then cut when you're sure, kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
100%. I do my best.
It's an amazing craft though, you know, and like that, a craft that isn't nearly as prolific as it used to be, I suppose, that kind of hand sewing craft.
It kind of comes in and out of fashion. Like I was saying earlier, like it was a really, really big for a while. Everyone was getting, especially around COVID too, everyone was getting into sourdough or sewing or something.
Banana bread.
Yes. But like, I think it's a skill that should be, like everyone should know how to sew a button on.
Yeah.
It should be a skill that people... I shouldn't say should. People like
No. Don't be afraid to say should, because I agree with you. And I'm somebody who's absolutely rubbish at sewing, and I completely agree with you.
I'm really bad at buttons, I must admit. I don't really have fastenings in anything I do. Try and keep it as like comfortable as possible for everyone.
But I mean, and it should be boys and girls. I think it should just be 100%. Something. I don't think, because honestly, full disclosure, if a button fell off my shirt, I would struggle to know if there was even thread in the house. Like, I'm
useless. Come and see me and I'll help you out.
Yes, yeah, I think I'll have to. So Milly Designs, that's M-I-L-Y Designs. You're on Instagram. And
correct.
Is that the best place for people to kind of trade with you?
Yes, they can Instagram me or email me or anything like that. All my details are on Instagram anyway. They can come and find me.
Okay, great.
Or pop in and see me, not me, but my stuff in the Magpie Collective.
Yes, in Waterford City.
Yes.
Brilliant stuff. Catherine DeCourcy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Success.
The Hot Desk with Mary O'Neill on WLR.
Thanks to MK Brazel, Chartered Accountants and Tax Advisors.
January is a great reset in many ways, whether that's in terms of your personal life, your business life. And joining me in studio now is Joe O'Regan. Joe is Tremor based. He's a fractional CFO and he is going to explain to us what that is. His company is called Intrinsic CFO, and I'm delighted to say Joe is going to be a mine of information for the next 10 minutes or so, explaining everything to me. Joe, good evening. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Mary, and Happy New Year to you and your listeners.
Yeah, thanks very much for coming in. I suppose before we kind of talk about what a fractional CFO is, because I think it's going to be a new term to a lot of people listening, give me a brief overview of your business background.
Sure, no problem at all. So I've been in the workforce since 2001, so the first 7 years of my career was as a management accountant in banking. The next 7 to 8 years of my career was in Big Four consulting, working with finance functions and finance directors and CFOs. And since 2016, I've been self-employed. So primarily as a fraction CFO, but I also worked in procurement consulting and in a procurement SaaS startup.
Okay, so what exactly is a fractional CFO then? Can you explain to our listeners what it is?
Sure, no problem. So if you think of a CFO is somebody who works in a business full time and helps basically making strategic financial decisions for the business with the owner of the business. Whereas a fractional CFO is somebody who will work in a business on a fractional basis. So, for example, it could be 3 to 4 days a month.
Okay.
And the typical business that will hire a fractional CFO is a business who wants that strategic advice and experience. But economically, it doesn't make sense for them to hire a full-time CFO.
Okay, all right. So ultimately, your company is a consultancy then, is it?
It's advisory. Exactly.
Okay. And where are your customers then? Where is your base usually?
Primarily in the southeast, but like I've worked with customers across the island of Ireland and further afield as well. But even in the digital world, I still like a bit of human contact. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my customers would be in the southeast, across all the counties in the southeast.
And across various sectors?
Various sectors, yeah. And you know what? Some of them choose you and you choose them. Mm-hmm. I work a lot with transport companies,
sure.
Companies in the tourism space, energy, professional services would be another one, obviously, because, you know, I work in professional services myself, so I find it relatively easy to advise other professional services professionals.
Okay, brilliant. And we're going to do a bit of an advice piece now, because like we said, it's kind of a time of reset, isn't it? So I suppose if we look then at how January is a time when, you know, resolutions happen. I know some people don't believe in resolutions, but I suppose, you know, if you kind of translate resolutions into a business sense, it is a lot of just planning, really, isn't it, for the year ahead. Why should businesses and SMEs in particular really focus on budgeting then at this time of the year? Can you give us some reasons why it's so important?
Yeah, of course. And it's a good question. And as the old saying goes, if you don't know where you're going, all roads will take you there.
Mm-hmm.
So why should you have a budget? Because if you don't have a budget, you're just relying on your bank balance to understand whether the business is going well or not. But also you've nothing to benchmark yourself against. So how do you know if you're going off course? Because you don't have a benchmark, you don't have a goal, a place you want to get to. And the budget is a benchmark, but also with the budget, it can be a benchmark against your industry as well. So what are the metrics that are the norm for your industry? And are you, like, is your actual performance ahead of your industry average, behind your industry average, on your industry average? How will you know if you don't sit down and map it out and create a budget to say, for example, right, I want to get to 10 million in revenue by the end of the year. So halfway through the year, you could be on 6 million of revenue. So you'll have a rough yardstick to say, do you know what, I'm probably going to exceed my revenue target for the year. But if you hadn't sat down at the start of the year, 6 million would have been, well, I think it's good. Mm-hmm. We'll just assume it's good.
I suppose you need to look at mitigating factors as well. And sometimes there are things we can't control. We don't know, you know, what lies ahead with the economy, macro, micro, external factors, all those things. So is it good to have a kind of a buffer in case things go wrong and you do need to kind of dip into funds you didn't know you'd need to dip into?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Like you know, we're talking about resolutions being personal or business, but like the person should have a rainy day fund and the business should have as
sure.
well. But
yeah.
A simple benchmark as well is you should have 90 days of cash.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some businesses might need more than 90 days of cash, some might be able to survive with less. But just a general rule would be that if, you know, the sky fell, as Chicken Licken said, and you've lost your biggest customer, you should still have enough money in the bank to cover your outgoings for the next 90 days,
including paying staff if you have staff and that kind
of
thing.
As I'd say to some of my own clients, can you keep the lights on? Can you pay the staff?
Mm-hmm.
So all your operational expenditure, can you cover that for the next 90 days?
Okay, so now is the time of the year when people are kind of doing all this and seeing what they have and everything. Okay, so when do you kind of, I suppose, need to review or adjust then in the course of the year? Because obviously January is kind of the reset point. But is there a point then, maybe a 6 month point in, where you kind of look and say, is this all going the way I wanted it to go? I know you mentioned the 6 million halfway through the year, but is it good to actually sit down and say, right, I'm at, you know, the end of Q2, what, you know, do I see is all this working, or do I need to do another mini budget at this time of the year?
Yeah, so good practice would be to review performance monthly.
Yeah.
So see how are we doing in month 1, 2, 3, etc. Are we on budget, ahead of budget, behind budget? But if we're going to change and readjust it, so the phrase we'd use is a forecast. And what is a forecast? It's your actual year to date. So say at the end of March, right, what was my 3 month actual plus my 9 month budget? We'll say it's just a very simple example that could differ from your initial budget. So say the example I've given you of 6 million in turnover 6 months in, but you expected 5, you might adjust upwards and you say, well, my year end now will be 11 million of revenue.
Okay.
or 12 million of revenue.
Okay, very good. And then I suppose making business plans as well. And, you know, a budget is one thing. A business plan is a whole other thing. And, you know, it's not just a one-off document. I suppose it's almost like a guidebook, isn't it, for the company?
Absolutely, yeah. It's like it's a living document.
Sure.
Would say with business plan, like what is a business plan? It's your purpose. It's why am I in business? Who do I service? And what are the resources I need to service my customers or my clients? So with the business, if you take a business plan versus a budget, you're typically looking what am I going to do this year? So between now and January of next year. With a business plan, you might take a longer term view. You might look out 3 years or 5 years into the distance and say, right, what am I going to do between now and 2029 or 2030. So you're looking further out, but without knowing, well, what's the purpose of the business? Why did I start the business? Why am I growing the business? It's going to be hard to have a good business plan. But But there's lots of advantages to having the business plan. If you decide you need bank funding, it's ready to go to you know, an external investor, whether it's a bank, a traditional bank, or an outside investor. But also just from your own point of view to say, right, where are we going beyond just 2026?
Okay. So from your experience in dealing with clients across multiple sectors and that, do most have a business plan, or is it something you kind of sometimes need to look under the bonnet and say you could probably do with one? Do you feel sometimes there's people who are winging it a little bit in these situations?
Yeah, being honest, I think, you know, some business owners are just, they're just too busy to either have one or to refresh one. But I suppose, you know, the message I'm relaying today is it's good practice to have one and to update one, because, you know, you were mentioning about the wider economy and stuff like that, that things change. Things change all the time. So it could be, do you know what, your own. So just start, like, if you're looking at your own business plan, you're going, right, I'm going to update it. A good starting point could be, are the assumptions I had the last time I put together my business plan, are they still valid? Am I still looking to say, do business with the same type of customer? Is my pricing right? Is my cost base right? So even just looking internally, going, is right, are they still valid? Are my assumptions off? Mm-hmm. But then the external environment, has any regulation impacted on my business? Have any taxes or tariffs impacted my business? My competitors, what are they up to? My customers, are my customers pushing back and saying, we can't tolerate the prices, your price increases, or whatever it is? So it's a combination of internal and external factors. But again, you know, to use the, you know, the about not if you don't know where you're going, all roads will lead you there. It's that reflection point to say, right, is what I thought was the direction for my business last year still valid? So sometimes, Mary, you could say, right, you know, if you're refreshing it yearly, there mightn't be that much of a change year to year.
Sure.
But if you look over the iterations over time, you could see big transformations.
Mm-hmm. So you can form trends, I suppose, as well, which is really helpful. You know, like if you're in business a long time and you can look back and say, well, you know, look at the way the plan kind of changed and look at the trends that emerged over those years, and then maybe it probably helps you with forecasting as well.
Absolutely. And it's like anything, Mary, and it's a great point. Like, the more you do it, the better you are at it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. But also with those trends as well, you might even just spot what are the emerging trends. Mm-hmm. So the historic trends will help you spot the emerging trends as well. Like, so it's, and that's the benefit of it as well. Like,
if there are people listening who are thinking, my God, I don't know where to start with the business plan, are there any kind of, I suppose, templates online or anything that might help people find, you know, kind of even get them started with a business plan?
Yeah, like, obviously, you know, we're in the AI world. Yeah. So you'll find, but even just, you know, just a simple starting point could be grabbing a sheet of paper, one sheet of paper, and going, where am I right now? Where do I want to be? What are the three or four priorities that I need to focus on to get me there?
We're looking at examples of businesses that saw major improvement, you know, and I know you'd probably, you know, for commercial sensitivity, don't necessarily want to name them. But like, if you can give examples, maybe even in the general space that they're in, of how planning helped them, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was, I suppose, one of my clients, when we first started working together, they had really long lead times in getting paid. Mm-hmm. So their debtors' days were approaching 60 days. So, you know, if we made a sale today, we're not going to get paid till early March.
Okay.
But I sat down with them, I reviewed how they recognised their revenue in their financial statements, but also how they booked the revenue. So a simple change for them was 10% deposit up front, 50% deposit when the product was ready in the factory, and the remaining 40% was paid before the customer received the product. That sliced the debtor's days in half. So what's the knock-on effect to them? They're getting paid quicker during seasonal times of the year where they previously had cash crunches. They had little or no cash crunches then, and basically they manage their cash flow better throughout the whole year, but especially during times of the year when seasonally cash was even tighter again.
Okay.
But their margins also, so their gross profit margin and their net profit margins increase. But going back to what I touched on earlier, I benchmarked them against six other companies in their industry, and just by coincidence, they were slap bang in the middle. So I showed them the path of, well, how do you catch up with and get up to the level of the tree ahead of you, as opposed to slide back to the tree behind you, or let the tree behind you overtake you.
Okay, brilliant. So if we're completely and utterly out of time, I'm afraid, if people want to find out more about you, Joe, and your company Intrinsic CFO, where do they go?
Yeah, no, absolutely, I'd be delighted to hear from anyone who's interested. So I'm easily found on LinkedIn, and also, you know, my company website, so I'm updating it, so there's going to be a new version of it coming out in the next week, but it's www.intrinsiccfo.com.
Brilliant stuff. Joe O'Regan, thank you very much. Really valuable advice today. Thanks a million.
Thanks very much, Mary.
Yeah, thanks again to Joe, to Catherine and to Tom, my guests on tonight's Hot Desk. John O'Shea is on his way with The Late Show. Have a lovely evening. Good night.